for almost 31 years, whose shadow looms large here. But hey, I get to love Frank too. And Sydney's vision to re-infuse the arts into Aspen, he figured that the focus on the arts had been lost years back, despite the noble origins of the Institute. Sydney's vision to re-infuse the arts through all the programming and to set up an individual separate arts program drove another guy named Eisner to say, I'm in. Let's be partners. And they were. And Michael is still my partner. And I'm a proud member of the arts program and very proud that this artisan residence position bears Sydney and Michael's name. So it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Iraq-Afghanistan panel, which will include a conversation between Michael Eisner and my favorite architect, Frank Gehry.
Thank you. How do I get up on this thing? Tommy, help.
So thank you, Jane. Welcome, everybody. It's really an honor to talk to Frank. He's won every award in architecture, the Pritzker Award and everything else. Interestingly, there was a Vanity Fair poll of 52 prominent people, including 13 Pritzker winners. And they selected almost unanimously Frank as the most important architect in the world since 1980.
So it's a pretty... He just told me about that. My fees are going up right away.
So I thought, because you, many of you here had just been involved with the FBI, first thing I would do is ask Frank what he thinks, and I hope there's a picture of the FBI headquarters, the J. Edgar Hoover headquarters. Is that... So, Frank, there's been a lot of talk about the FBI and Clinton and Trump, but nobody's talked about this unbelievable building.
The first word I'd say is transparency. And the second word, which I'm copying from your former speaker, is Lordy.
Anyway, so that sums up Frank's point of view about the FBI building, which is rather brutalistic and then criticized ruining Pennsylvania Avenue for, I think they started thinking about it in 1960. I think it opened around 1975. They're talking about closing it now. So maybe what's outside has created some problems inside.
We could turn it into a concert hall real easy.
A great segue, because the program, and we do want to spend a little bit of time on it, is architecture and music. And I think I could say you're interested in music before architecture, when you moved to LA and your mother would take you to concerts. That's fairly accurate?
She took me to concerts in Toronto when I was a kid. And she played violin, but I never heard her play it. But she talked about music, and she also introduced me to the arts, to painting way back then. And it was when I got to LA, one of the first projects I did that got notoriety was the Shed in Maryland, Meriwether Post Pavilion, which was a music shed for the Rouse Company. And I think it was the Washington Symphony Orchestra. So.
Well, you have had a long interest in music. You were supposed to design, all your artist friends wanted you to design MoCA, on Grand Avenue, and then Isazaki, I don't know what he did, stabbed you in the back or something, but anyway, he... Well, maybe he didn't stab you in the back. Somebody stabbed you in the back. In any event, down the street, Disney Hall, one of the most famous buildings now in the world, and the acoustics are unbelievable. The building is unbelievable, but the getting it done, a movie could be made about.
Yes.
And what is it about your desire to bring music, the symphony, and Disney Hall together that finally culminated in it happening without doing the whole movie?
Well, there was the director of the LA Philharmonic at the time was Ernest Fleischman, a Brit. And he had seen the Meriwether Post. He asked me to think about helping him with the Hollywood Bowl, which I did, and got to know him. And he took it upon himself, for whatever reason, to have me come as a regular to many concerts. So he would invite us to the concerts.
Was this after Lillian Disney had given
50? No, before, way before.
Oh, way before.
So he was my music teacher, let's say. He introduced me to all the greatest and the best in the music, classical music world. And so it became more intense for me as a topic of interest.
But at a certain point, Lillian Disney had put up all this money and before you were involved, and all there was a garage. And nobody trusted that you were able to pull off what it is you have pulled off.
Well, I don't know, for maybe people in the audience be interested in this. Whenever there's a cultural project and there's a board, the members of the board are always somebody that knows a lot about building.
I'm going to get to your view of developers in a minute.
And so that's, they messed with it and cost the project a lot of money. And I couldn't do anything. They were on the board. They said, you got to do this, you got to do that.
Yeah, but when you finally got...
I finally got it.
No, but the interesting thing is the Disney family selected Diane Disney, Frank, and the mother, who's a great woman, at 98 years old, 97 years old, totally with it, said to me, I'm going to go with what my daughter wants. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
And then one day, the design, and they showed her the interiors of your work, which is all, of course, beautiful. And then Jane and I were with her, and the image that we now know was in the front page of the New York Times.
Yeah, she didn't like that.
She said, oh my God, what has my daughter done to me? 6 weeks later, she completely changed her mind. I don't think she lived to see it finished, did she?
No, she didn't. She was great to work with. I had more fun with that lady. I used to go visit her and have tea, and she took me through all the Walt stories. I mean, you probably know all of them, but she showed me the collection what's that?
The trains.
No. The Delftware. She told me showed me this collection of Delftware that she and Walt collected. And I said, but Lily, it's the stuff from the cheap tourist stores. It's not the real stuff. And she started giggling. She says, yeah, we love that kind of. So after the building was done, and she was gone, of course, but I designed a fountain in the garden for her made of the cheap Delftware. And guess what happened? Delft heard what it was for and sent the real stuff. So we broke up all these beautiful pots and made this thing, but it's the real stuff. But she was like that. It was crazy, dude.
Michael Jackson, I don't know how this comes into my mind, was obsessed with two things. Walt Disney, and he would go to Lillian Disney's house and go through his drawers to see what his socks looked like at all. And you, he was obsessed with two things. And he would call me up and say,
Michael Jackson.
I've never tried. Can I?
Well, he did call me once. So I picked up the phone. And he said, Michael, I thought he was kidding.
He went to sleep in Disney Hall.
Yeah,
but
he said he loved my work and blah, 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 blah. And so I was at the doctor's office. We shared the doctor, apparently.
You didn't have as many faceless as he did.
No, it was Arnie.
Oh, my God.
So I went there, and Arnie said, your fan is sitting in my office. Would you go visit him? So I went down the office, and there's Michael Jackson eating a sandwich. And he looks at me, and he says, are you in the film business? He didn't know who the fuck I was.
No, he... when the name became Disney Hall, he wanted to sleep in Disney Hall, which was the ultimate, I guess, imprimaturship on your building. But, okay, so let's go from Disney Hall to this the whole acoustics.
Well, can I talk about that?
Sure.
So making a concert hall is about, it is Shakespeare's thing about all the world's a stage and blah, blah, blah. You know that all of us are players. And so the important thing is to understand that there's an orchestra and there's an audience and they've got to connect for it to be workable. And they've got to feel that connection. And so it talks about understanding that and creating intimacy and all of those things, which is hard to do when you got over 2,000 people and the acoustical requirements and all that stuff. But that's what made it work. And I think if you've been there, it does, people tell me they like it for that. The orchestra does feel very part of the audience, and that makes them play better. The audience likes it better. The orchestra feels that they like it better, and blah, 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 blah.
One of the things you've proved is that architecture is a commercially viable thing. Architecture pulls people to it, and once they get to it, they enjoy it. And that has created, instead of the banal architecture of the 70s or the 60s in this country, certain architects have created iconic places for people to go. And the term star architect, has now been attributed to you as the leader of the star architect world. So how do you like being a star architect?
No? That's I'm sure there are journalists in the crowd, and I'm gonna get, journalists did create the name, and then they use it to lampoon us with. I think it's not a very accurate.
Well, you are one anyway.
Because it's placed on a lot. I mean, it's indiscriminate. Everybody's a star architect. Everybody. It's not.
I'm not sure I agree with you. There are a certain number of people that, you know, you have, whether it's Disney Hall or Bill Bow, which was voted at least. Philip Johnson said it's the greatest building built in the last 75 years. And Bilbao, which was a, you know, okay city in northern Spain, nobody went to it, now gets about 900,000 tourists a year. Some of the other architects have created things that create interest in the public that never before has been found. You certainly go all over Europe, and what do you go to? Do you go to famous buildings that were built thousands of years ago by architects? So I think the idea of a star architect, which sounds stupid, I know the word, but you have given us, and developers, what do you think about developers? I mean, you have made some developers very successful. but they also drive you crazy.
No, it's like the board members.
But isn't everybody?
They know everything about building, and so it ends up very pro forma. And if you try to break out of those norms, it's not easily convincing. But once you do it, and I mean, like we developed a lot of computer technology with Dassault Systems, with the French guys, and we did a tower in New York with the complicated curtain wall with zero change orders. So, but when I tell that to my developer, they say, "Well, you know, we don't work that way."
Well, how is your?
But they do. They did. We were getting them to work that way. It does work, and then they like it. They're happy.
So I'm aware of a couple of developers that have approached you. A guy by the name of Donald Trump at one time has this close personal relationship politically and architecturally with you. How did that go? That go as well as other things are going on with him now? So what happened?
Well, I had turned him down several times on other things, but and I'd never met him, but I was in New York, I was staying at the Peninsula, and he called, and I was with one of the people in my office, and I said, "Well, why don't we go over? It'll be interesting, at least, to experience this." So he was raving. It was just when Bilbao opened, and the press. There was a lot of press about it.
And you went to the throne room and the
he wanted
Caesar's
yeah,
Palace.
And
in
he
New York.
Wanted. I guess what he wanted was to capitalize on my press.
Starchitect.
To get him approval of the tallest building in Manhattan on 59th Street. So you know, on 59th Street in the river, where somebody built those low rise and put his name on. That was the site. There wasn't a chance in hell that he was going to get approved. But anyway, he was nasty when I turned him down. As I left, he slammed the door and said, "I'm going to build it with or without you. I'll give you 2 days," and slammed the door. And 2 days later, the mother called me.
And said?
And I said, "No." And he hung up the phone. And then, as luck would have it, I went to a charity thing in New York, and they put me at the same table as. And my wife was with me, and he came in and sat down, but he sat down next to me, but turned his seat back. And I said, "Donald, you don't have to." He said, "I don't need you." That's the end of it.
So that isn't one developer. Some are better than that. No, actually, last night, I was talking to Frank, and you get a sense of his contrarian, creative point of view, which has created all this great architecture, because we were talking about what was going to happen to the FBI before us. And he said to Katie Couric, "Why don't we start a magazine called Fake News? And then inside of it is only real news." And we all thought.
So I got any takers?
But you've had, you know, eventually with Disney Hall, good experience in Bilbao, good experience with Barry Diller in the IAC building in New York. But after Bilbao, some of the iconic developers, Steve Wynn came to you as well to do a casino in Atlantic City, right?
But I don't know, do you know him? He's very hands-on and very controlling. And so every time, I asked Philip Johnson to work with me on it because Philip was kind of old and I thought he could do a cameo and it would be fun for him. And so we were making models, Philip and I, and Steve would change things. And it became obvious that we couldn't work for him. And anyway.
Didn't you fly on his plane to Bilbao?
With Philip, with Charlie Rose, with everybody. It was all big deal.
And didn't, when you got there, Steve Wynn said, "You're my architect."
Yes.
And you said?
I said. He said, "I've found my architect." And I said, "I haven't found my client."
So let me understand acoustics. Is acoustics, to get the right acoustics, because your wife is telling me at your house where you're giving little concerts, all you had to do to get the right acoustics was open a door at the back a bit and the acoustics would be right.
That was not quite, but that was part of it, yeah.
Well, so how did you get in Disney Hall?
Well, so we had a Japanese company, Nagata Acoustics, and Ernest Fleischman liked them, hired them, and I met with Dr. Nagata and Ernest at the Kempinski Hotel in Berlin for a lunch, and Dr. Nagata was the student of Dr. Kramer, who was the original acoustician for Berlin Symphony, Berlin Philharmonie. And that was the most acclaimed concert hall at the time. We sat down to lunch and Kramer says, "This is my favorite student." And Nagata said, "This is my favorite mentor." And I asked, I waited a while and I said, "What's the best shape for a concert hall?" And Kramer said, "Like that, with the conductor here." And that's Berlin. And Nagata said, "That, with the conductor here." And I said, "So what do I do now?" And I remember they got into a fight.
But is there?
But we didn't do any. I spent a lot of time, and there's a hall that isn't the greatest visually inside, and it's got a lot of problems. But the building in Amsterdam, I forget names, the Concertgebouw, is a box, but it's a wider box than at that time the model was Boston Symphony Hall, which was narrower and longer, and so by widening it made for a more friendly people relationship. So I got fixated on that, and the Japanese company at that time was making 1 to 10 scale models of all the concert halls and putting them in a vacuum and introducing nitrogen, which is 1/10 of air apparently. And they were using that, this was brilliant, they were using that to test the differences between the halls. And so we were able to build a model of Disney, do that at 1 to 10, do that and test every seat and compare it to all the great halls of the world at that time.
But so, does it have to be wood, or is that no, psychoacoustics that can be?
Wood is the warmth that I feel that people enjoy, you know, it's friendlier. That was my thing. It could have been plaster. All you need is 2 inches of cement plaster as a bouncing wall. But
so one thing I'm interested in, usually when I read a biography, I'm into the first 4 chapters, and the rest of it I can read in the New York Times, because I'm interested in how people became what they became. And your background and even your relationship with Donald Trump today, all of this goes back to a background in grandparents moving from Poland to Canada, you living a fairly Jewish environment there, having a lot of...
At Toronto, and I remember as a kid going to restaurants that had signs outside, "No Jews allowed" in Toronto.
And you experienced a lot of anti-Semitism. You went to school in Timmins when your father made one-arm
slot machines.
You were the only Jewish kid in the class.
And I got beat up for killing Christ, yeah.
Right, so you've had...
I was 8 years old, so I asked my mother what I did.
And what did she say?
No, I didn't do it.
Oh, so then you, your father gets sick, you move to L.A., and you're in the... actually, you live a couple blocks from where Disney Hall is today.
Yeah, they lost everything, so it was pretty grim.
So you were a poor kid from Canadian Timmins, Toronto.
I became a truck driver.
So all of that, I watched the, you obviously became somewhat insecure being thrown into this world.
A little bit.
But you associated yourself with artists, the growing artist community in LA versus the architectural community.
So that's a longer story. So when I was a kid, my grandfather read Talmud to me. He wasn't super religious, but he always wanted to read. And the Talmud starts with the word why. So it's a sort of a built-in curiosity that he was offering me as what I should do, to always be curious. And I think that served me well. And when I graduated from architecture school, the culture of architecture was not curious. I mean, there were Frank Lloyd Wright and Corbusier and all that, but it hadn't filtered down to...
How did you even get to architecture school, being a truck driver? It doesn't seem to be a natural progression.
I took night classes at Los Angeles City College, and then I took a class in ceramics. I was kind of interested in ceramics, and it was a guy named Glenn Lukens. It was at SC, and it was at night. And I took the first term, and then I took a second. On the second, he called me aside, and he said, you know, I'm building a house. I'd like you to come see it. So we went, and it was being built by Rafael Soriano, who was a pretty well-known architect. And Rafael Soriano was on site, and he was telling the steel guys to move the beams and all this stuff. And I must have lit up like a, you know, oh my God. And after that meeting, Glenn took me aside and said, I'm going to enroll you in the night class in architecture at SC. There was no other school that had architecture. And it was expensive. And I think he might have paid for it, because I wouldn't have had the money. And from that, I skipped into second year. And so, in second year, the teacher, at the end of a few months, took me aside and said, this isn't for you, Frank.
Didn't your father also think this wasn't for you, and your mother thought you would be a failure?
That was separate.
but when she passed away, you found all your...
I found her collection of
my... So she didn't think that in the end.
But the guy that, in second year, that told me to get out, that was anti-Semitism. My family name was Goldberg, not Gary. Gary is a fabrication. So at SC, Goldberg was kind of an Auslander, you know, at that time. And after I graduated and after I got known and all that stuff, I used to run into the guy, and he'd say, okay, I know, don't tell me.
So you found in SC, in architecture school, and architects in general, could be oppressive, could be constrictive, whether
it wasn't curious enough for me, and I knew the art world. I didn't know it personally, but I knew what was going on. I knew the artists. I followed all of them. And SC had an art school, so there was stuff going on that more interested me than what was going on in architecture. And so by accident, I met some of the artists who at one of my buildings. They were wandering around looking, and we met, and they invited me, and I became part of that group. And it was more about curiosity, more about materials, more about I wonder if could it be possible to do this or
freedom.
That. And it was a freer thinking model, and it appealed to me. So I went. You know, in the old days, architecture was an art. It somehow lost that thing, you know, because Giotto, the great painter, became an architect. El Greco, the great painter, became an architect. Michelangelo became an architect. They went from artist to architect, so it was a step up at that time. And I'm not asking for that to happen again, but at least parody.
So in Sidney Pollack's film on you, he interviews Milton Friedman.
Wexler,
who's a psychiatrist. And I said to Sidney Pollack at the time, what psychiatrist would ever allow, what patient would ever allow a psychiatrist to go on film and talk about a patient? And he said, well, Frank thought that was the best way to understand Frank. So I said, Frank, on the car ride here, can I ask you what Milton Wexler did that released you from the insecurity of going in a different direction from all your colleagues, you know, going for it, taking the risks, going from being a boy to a man? So now I'm asking you, what did he tell you then? Because he's not alive, I can't find him. But how great was that process?
That was great because it was he was a tough taskmaster. He was no bullshit. It wasn't lie on the couch stuff. He put me in a group of 15 people. I was one.
Oh my God.
And we met two afternoons a week. And the group was filled with a variety of people. Some people from your business, some people.
Who? No, I'm sorry.
Anyway, and for 2 years I sat there and didn't talk. And one day the whole group of them descended on me and said, we know you're sitting here in judgment of us. And we know you don't like us and you have things to say and blah, 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 blah. And for God's sakes, come out. And that was terrifying to me. And it took a few times, but then of course they had me and I had to, and that broke the logjam. That it was from there on that I was coasting. It was a big deal too.
No, I understand. And if you think back at what you went through moving from Canada to LA, and your father, you know, they stopped making slot machines in Canada. I remember going to Canada as a kid because my sister, who was right there, skated in the same rink that you skated in Schumacher. And the
first rink I ever skated in that one. And Frank Mihaljevic too, same rink.
So the two things I remember about that rink was the French fries with vinegar.
Yeah, I remember
which
that.
Which were fantastic. Yeah. And the actual feeling of the rink. But coming from there to LA, father out of work, and then being released to be creatively what your grandmother was doing with you on the floor playing Making Cities? Was that what she was doing?
Yes, that was, I was very young, and she would go to the wood shop and get wood cuttings. There were all these funny shapes, and she'd, for the fire, to make the fire in the stove, and she'd take the sack and open them on the floor and sit on the floor with me, and I would build cities with her. And that was an important bit of information too to grow up with.
Wow. So a couple of things that are in the future that are monumental and extremely important, and I'm interested in, is the long running relationship with the Eisenhower family and the government to do the Eisenhower Memorial on the Mall. So where does that stand, and what have you gone through to get through the family, the government?
Everything's an opera, you know. This, it was a competition I won. And I won because I had a tapestry idea. It's in front of the Department of Education. So the building would overpower the memorial if you didn't do something. So the idea of putting a tapestry of some kind, I had no idea how we would build it. And we showed on the tapestry over time, we showed Abilene, Kansas, because in all of Ike's speeches, he talks about Abilene.
And it's 500 feet wide, stainless steel tapestry,
right.
Not like a little blanket.
Well, we had a guy that works with us, Tomasz Osinski. He's an artist from Poland who is incorrigible. He never says no, he can't do something. So he invented the machines to make this tapestry. And he had to pass GSA with the welds, because GSA requires each weld to last 200 years. And they tested it, and he passed. And there's millions of welds in this tapestry. The saga was what was on the tapestry, what should be shown. The family wanted to show Ike, and they were probably right, as the world leader he was, that saved the world, all those nice things that he deserves credit for. And
I saw the original tapestry. It was fantastic. And it was you looking at Ike from the beginning.
Yeah.
And the granddaughters thought that was too hicky, right?
Well, they were a little upset. They wanted this different view of him. And I think over time, I came to understand their point of view. And, you know, you can argue both ways. But it was brokered by Jim Baker, who came in, thank God, and made the connection between the family and the tapestry and me, and solved it all. And so it's going ahead. It's under construction. It'll open to 2020. And the tapestry will have the French coast at Pontoac, where Ike and the troops went up. But now it's a peaceful vision of it.
You met with the president of France.
I met with Macron, and he's excited about it, or was.
You like him better than Trump?
Yeah, so far. I like his wife.
that actually sounds like Trump. So it's going to happen.
Yes, and it's the first, I think it's the first and only GSA project that's under budget. I worry about those things. Michael told me not to worry about it.
He is too sensitive. You know, when you get 800,000 people to go to Bilbao, and it was on budget, and Frank will tell you why it was on budget, but you look at these monumental architecture, and you can't imagine those lines that don't go straight, how they could be on budget, but they are. But I think it's irrelevant in the total. I mean, we're not asking what the Pantheon cost. And I'm sure it went a little bit over budget. But the other thing that's amazing to me, having come from Manhattan, where if you put up a statue in Central Park, you go through 20 years of angst because nobody wants you to touch it. You built this fantastic museum in the center of the Bois de Boulogne. How did anybody let you do that? seems like hard to get done.
It was.
That's fantastic.
It was because There's an existing building in the park that Dior owned. It was a bowling alley. And we were only allowed to build the new building, the height of that, which would have been not so gracious. And I met with the mayor at that time and explained to him about the idea of building a garden building. And I showed him pictures of the garden, you know, the buildings in England in fact, the Grand Palais, and said if we used glass, which was, and it's against the project because you can't hang art on glass. So we decided to make a sort of a garden structure and inside of it build a solid building that takes the arc. And then we proposed that the space between the building and the glass could be used for art. And to that end, I invited Daniel Buren, who's an old friend, to come at me with whatever he wanted in this space. And he sure did. If anybody saw it, he put stripes and colors all over it. My building was totally, but that's the spirit of it. And he overdid it, and thank God they took it down. But but it is glass, and the glass is decorative in a sense. It was the only way we could get a volumetric building.
It's a fantastic building. So when I went to Disney, the Imagineers that Peel had designed, very inbred, very creative, but very stuck on their own ways. And I thought bringing in Frank, which was against everything they'd ever done, they never went to the outside. And so the first thing we did together was the corporate head, and none of these buildings, because Disney's very private about everything, none of these buildings are as famous as Bilbao say, but I think they're great. One of them, which I think we have the slide for, was the corporate headquarters of Disneyland. Is that up there? Which the Disneyland cast members first were like, oh my God, and now don't touch anything. They love it more than anything. And that opened up for Disney the ability to go outside our company and use people who were not born in LA necessarily and went to USC necessarily, and played on the football team necessarily, as Walt's son-in-law did. And it changed the whole thing. The next thing we did was a project in Euro Disney, outside the theme park. Is that up there? And outside the theme park, but only about 80 yards away. It was called Downtown Disney. And we had a competition inside. Frank showed one thing, and then we had a very traditional Disneyland internal architect do the other. And there were 80 of us in the room. 78 picked the other architect. Frank Wells and I picked Frank. We won. That sounds like Trump, too. And in the course of building Euro Disney, Frank calls me up and he says, I've done a lot of deals with developers, and you have put the guy, your CFO, in charge of real estate, and he is ruining your company. And within 2 weeks, we made a change. And everything went smoothly after that.
Thereafter.
Third thing we did, which is really pretty much unknown, was in downtown Anaheim, in downtown Anaheim, a gas station is on one corner, a 7-Eleven is on another corner, and God knows what are the other corners. I said, Frank, we need a We need a hockey practice arena for our professional team. And Frank really jumped into this. I didn't understand his Canadian background. And we got this great practice arena, which the inside was a Canadian hockey rink, and the outside was these two stainless steel things. And I called up Frank, and I said, Frank, I love it, it's great, but it looks to me like they're two breasts, and they're not side by side. And he said, you now understand me. And that, if you ever get to Anaheim, and you're going to go to Disneyland, forget Disneyland, go to see this great hockey rink with these two breasts this way. And then we had a lot of conversation, and you may just, I know we're running, are we out of time, but sexuality is in architecture, yes?
I suppose it's in everything, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, but we've had this conversation.
Architects. Where are you going?
I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to lunch, obviously. Anyway, the last building that Frank and I worked on together is a building that we finished last night at 10 o'clock. It was constructed in Aspen by the Harriman Construction Company. It's way at the bottom of Snowmass. It has no function whatsoever. It is a meeting house. It has a table. If I ever find anybody to meet with, that's where we'll meet. And it is spectacularly beautiful. And Frank and I have been talking about this building for a decade. He did 60 models of it. And I am proud to have this building. I'm proud to have a friend, Frank, and I thank you for those four buildings and everything else you've done.
I want to add one thing. I met her first.
Jane. Where did you meet her, by the way? I don't remember that.
Jane Eisner asked me to work as part of a team she was on to do the Children's Museum in downtown Los Angeles.
Right.
Many years ago.
And with all the artists. With the
and I loved her then, and I still do, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. You can also find this discussion in full later today on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this live broadcast of the Ideas Festival comes from Obermeyer Wood Investment Counsel, an independent investment advisor committed to helping clients navigate life's financial decisions. Learn more about the firm's team and approach at obermeyerwood.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale, your news, your music, your station. We now join the TED Radio Hour, already in progress.
She kind of raised her eyebrows at that. Last profession, state senator.